Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. Today in the cafe, talk about a long family vacation.
We've been through Europe, Southern Africa, and now we're kind of working our way through Asia.
Faiza Almasri and Faith Lapidus introduce us to the Rivenbark family. Remember the TV series Star Trek, where crew members were able to diagnose almost anything with a simple swipe of a tricorder?
Yeah, it's a really good analogy because essentially we can take a sample of whether it's soil or air, and in our case, water, and we can sequence the DNA out of it and tell you what's there.
Tom Bonsi is here to tell us about his trip to an experimental laboratory in the Pacific Northwest. George Pudich brings us the story of a creature that is as quick as a cheetah. However, it's not an animal. It's a robot.
This robot can actually jump about 40 centimeter high, and it can land very safely, and it can run a sprint because of the special motor technology we developed.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. Many families take their school-age children on vacation, usually traveling for a few days or a few weeks during breaks in the school schedule. But Tim and Julie Rivenbark made plans for a longer vacation with their two kids. The family is on a year-long trip around the world, visiting 30 countries. As Faiza Almasri tells us, it's a learning experience for them all. Faith Lapidus is here in the cafe to narrate.
The Rivenbarks know exactly what they want in a family vacation.
We want to see as much of the world as we can.
Julie Rivenbark says they're doing just that.
We've been through Europe, Southern Africa, and now we're kind of working our way through Asia. So we've been to a bunch of big cities like Dubai and Johannesburg and Rome and Bangkok.
They've also spent time in the countryside, kayaking in Italy, flying in hot air balloons in Myanmar, hiking to the Everest Base Camp in Nepal, and going on safari in South Africa. Tim Rivenbark says making new friends is one of the most interesting experiences of the trip.
People have been extremely friendly, very welcoming, and love our kids. Interacting with them and their reaction to see our kids enjoying themselves in their country has been rewarding. We give them the sight, and they leave comments and feedback on our site as well. So we get feedback and responses from the folks that we've met along the way.
11-year-old Tyler has enjoyed learning about the people they've met.
I learned in Africa that people have very different lifestyles than in America.
Julie points to the benefits for her children of spending several weeks in each of their destinations.
They really see kind of the differences in the world that they might not have gotten even if we had just taken a 1 or 2 week trip to some of these countries. So I think that the longer that we travel, the more impact it has on how they see the world. I can see them changing more than they can see themselves.
She says their 5 week stay in India was an eye-opening experience for Tyler and his sister Kara.
India has totally impacted how they see the world. They realize what we have at home, something as simple as a clean, quiet street to walk down. They used to take that for granted, and it goes further than that. Not having to brush their teeth with bottled water all of the time or worrying about kind of how clean the food is going to be when they eat it. We've been living through that now for 3 months. The other thing that Tyler is learning, he and I are both learning Mandarin, because we are going to be in 6 weeks, we'll be in China and Taiwan, so he has that on his plate as well.
Kara knows that will be important.
Well, at first people really understand English, and then after India, a lot of people didn't know English very much.
It took the family a year to prepare for the trip, and simplifying their life was the first item on the agenda. They sold their house and cars. Julie quit her job as a physician's assistant, and Tim took an unpaid leave of absence from his work. As they travel from country to country, their only luggage is a backpack filled with lightweight, washable clothes and whatever else they need.
Everything that we are bringing with us on this trip, we have to carry on our backs. So there's a lot of details such as trying to stay in warmer climates along the way, essentially an endless summer.
It was a very liberating experience. It's great just being able to carry what you need on your back, and I really don't miss the things that we have at home. What has become more important is making these memories as a family and taking those with us instead.
Tyler and Kara both have iPads so they can text their friends and communicate with teachers to stay up to date with their schoolwork. Tyler is also creating a 365-day video blog.
Each day, I take all the video of everything that we did. So all the clips of the video that we had for that day, I put them together, edit them a little bit, and then I kind of come out with this one video of the day of everything that we did and post them on YouTube for everyone to see.
And there are many more posts to come. The Rivenbarks still have 6 more months on the road. They'll keep heading east, visiting Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, China, and Australia. To follow their adventures, visit their website, earthtrekkers.com. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Just imagine how cool it would be to detect rare or invasive species, study biodiversity, or estimate fish abundance with just a scoop of air or a dip of water. It'd be like science fiction come true. Well, science fiction is indeed becoming reality through a new sampling technology called environmental DNA. Correspondent Tom Bonsi explains.
If you're old enough to remember the original Star Trek series, you might remember how crew members carried a versatile device they called the tricorder.
Make a swing around our perimeter. Scan for dicoronium in the atmosphere.
Landing parties from the Starship Enterprise used their tricorders on strange new worlds to instantly read out what was in their surroundings.
It's almost like something out there knows I'm scanning.
That was dreamed up in the mid-1960s. Now more than 40 years later, environmental researchers and surveyors can match Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, sort of.
Yeah, it's a really good analogy because essentially we can take a sample of whether it's soil or air, and in our case, water, and we can sequence the DNA out of it and tell you what's there.
Professor Ryan Kelly uses the technique called environmental DNA, or eDNA for short, in his University of Washington lab. The technology hasn't been miniaturized yet into a handheld device like on Star Trek, but give it a few years. For now, here's how the process works. All living creatures are constantly shedding or excreting their telltale DNA into the environment. In Kelly's Seattle lab, his team filters out and amplifies the genetic material. They are currently working with water samples collected from Puget Sound.
You take this gel, you walk over to the black light.
There it is.
And you turn that on.
Ryan says the cost of gene sequencing has plummeted in recent years. That makes DNA screening practical.
This is already very competitive and will be sort of a slam dunk for some monitoring applications in the near future.
Environmental DNA can be used in two ways. One is to identify all of the creatures that live in a certain place. The other is to confirm the presence or absence of a specific critter, typically an invasive or endangered species. Karen Goldberg runs the new eDNA lab at Washington State University in Pullman. She's one of the first biologists in the northwestern U.S. to take the tool from demonstration experiments to practical application.
It's extremely useful for species that are really hard to find.
Goldberg sees potential to get answers more efficiently, safely, and with less destruction compared to traditional survey techniques. Those could include snorkeling, netting, or using an electric current to temporarily stun fish.
I have spent many hours looking for species that I was pretty sure were there, looking under rocks, looking in water, doing all kinds of surveys.
The newer way to figure out what's where is rapidly catching on around the world. In Vietnam, zoologists are using it to locate the last wild specimens of the Yangtze giant soft-shelled turtle. In Trinidad, a researcher is using eDNA to track down endangered golden tree frogs. And in Madagascar, it's being used to identify amphibian diseases. For her part, Karen Goldberg has used the sensitive DNA screening to confirm the local extinction of a leopard frog in northern Idaho. She's also been hired to determine the extent of the spread of the New Zealand mud snail, a tiny invasive that's infesting lakes and streams in Washington state. Now the U.S. Bureau of Land Management wants Goldberg to look for the Columbia spotted frog in eastern Oregon and Nevada. The rare amphibian is a candidate for federal threatened species listing.
We're absolutely at this point where proof of concept has been established. I don't think everyone necessarily is on board yet, but I think a majority of the people are on board.
Natural resource managers are looking for evidence that the eDNA methods are getting better at reporting what's there with a low number of errors. This has gotten the most scrutiny in the Great Lakes region, where both false positives and missed detections have occurred while monitoring for invasive Asian carp. A related research goal is to more accurately pin down how long environmental DNA lingers and how far it can drift in different environments. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Scientists have been experimenting with four-legged robots for years, trying to see if they could be used as pack animals for carrying heavy loads over a difficult terrain. However, the machine's power requirements limited their potential. That has changed with a running robot designed by a group of engineers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that operates on batteries rather than heavy gasoline-powered motors.
Scientists say their robots will soon be able to run like cheetahs. But for now, the different technologies that will bring them closer to everyday life are still being tested. One of the obstacles continues to be power consumption. These complicated machines are still relatively heavy, and their numerous motors require a lot of energy to run. The most powerful among them are either tethered to a power source or have a gasoline-powered generator on board. But engineers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have designed a 30-kilogram cheetah-like robot that is light enough to run on batteries.
This robot can actually jump about 40 centimeters high, and it can land very safely, and it can run a sprint because of the special motor technology we developed.
Sangbae Kim, director of MIT Biomimetics Robotic Lab, says the robot needs only about 700 watts of power. Its limbs and other parts were made in a 3D printer and reinforced with a strong lightweight plastic called Kevlar, used for modern military helmets and body suits.
The frame has to be very light and then very stiff. So we designed this frame to handle these high forces and then high shock.
But the development of MIT's robot is not without setbacks. Its limbs must sustain tremendous force, and sometimes they break. Kim says another special feature is the custom-made motor controller.
It's also designed by us because none of the commercially available product can handle this kind of power.
Researchers say the new technologies used on this robot may find their way to artificial limbs, as well as other high-tech machines being developed to replace humans at back-breaking jobs. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Security breaches at Sony and other major companies have raised some questions about the safety of corporate and consumer data. The biggest risk for consumers remain fraud or theft. And as Michael Sullivan reports from Los Angeles, corporations are now facing a higher level of threat than they once did.
On Christmas Day, Sony's PlayStation network was targeted by hackers. The company had just experienced a massive data breach 1 month earlier when hackers released troves of corporate data to the public. The infiltrators were unhappy with the Sony film The Interview, which made fun of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. U.S. authorities believe North Korea was behind the attack. North Korea has denied it. Others say that private hackers must have been involved. Whoever was responsible, the data breach created a crisis for Sony. In September, Home Depot revealed a 5-month-long attack on its payment terminals that led to stolen data on tens of millions of its customers. An earlier breach was aimed at customers of Target stores. Each security breach is different, but analyst Hugh Thompson of the security firm Bluecoat says the attacks are targeted and the attackers are persistent, and that off-site hackers often focus on specific employees.
people like system administrators, and then going online to social media and finding out what their favorite restaurant is, what their favorite sports team is, and then crafting an email that looks so painfully normal that you really think that it is from a friend or is from a colleague.
The recipient is tricked into clicking on a link and downloading a virus. Security firms like Bluecoat and Cyfort work with major companies to prevent and identify cyber attacks. But Cyfort co-founder Fengmin Gong says that today some hackers belong to complex organizations and they're patient.
So they can get hold of a lot of toolkits. A lot of attack techniques and solutions get packaged, so easily available to them.
He says they are part of an industrial-scale hacking economy. Online commerce is estimated at $1.5 trillion, and security breaches have many consumers worried. Internet sites like PayPal aim to help buyers do their online shopping safely. PayPal's Andy Steingrubel spoke with VOA via Skype.
Because of the work I do, I'm actually kind of an optimist on a lot of this, about how well at least some companies are doing in upping their game, in developing better next-generation defenses, and the way technology and innovation are leading the way on keeping companies and their customers safer.
PayPal works with so-called ethical hackers to find flaws in the system, and late last year, the company paid an Egyptian engineer $10,000 for reporting vulnerabilities. These experts say consumers can protect themselves by updating security software, keeping passwords safe, and guarding personal data, but that businesses need to double their efforts against an escalating threat from sophisticated hackers. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thoughtless habits and practices, a bottle dropped here, a bag thrown there, are creating garbage dumps in the world's oceans. The flotilla of debris moves with the currents and harms fish and marine mammals that either ingest or get entangled in it. But for some organisms, it's home. Scientists have discovered a wide diversity of microbes colonizing and thriving on plastic that is polluting the ocean in the so-called platysphere. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel is here in the cafe to explain.
It takes about 6 weeks for a plastic bag or bottle to ride the surface currents from the U.S. East Coast to the Sargasso Sea in the center of the North Atlantic. The area is a gyre, essentially a big whirlpool that traps and swirls the debris, which, unlike other types of trash in the ocean, never biodegrades. This is where Tracy Mincer, a microbiologist with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and colleagues from the Marine Biological Laboratory join students aboard a Sea Education Association vessel to sample plastic debris for microbes.
We hypothesized that the microbes on plastic were specifically interacting with it, rather than just a random association. It's not just a flypaper that's just grabbing onto anything. Things are actually specifically interacting with plastic for a reason.
The team skimmed the surface with fine nets, collecting confetti-sized bits of plastic. They analyzed the plastic with electron scanning tools and gene sequencing techniques. Mincer says they found rich colonies of bacteria, including some they hadn't expected. They called those pit formers.
We were surprised when we saw microbes that appeared to be hydrolyzing the plastic and etching into it, as well as just a whole other amazing ecosystem that was thriving on this plastic surface.
Mincer says that the organisms in this plastosphere were different from those in the surrounding nutrient-poor water, indicating that the plastic acts as an artificial microbial reef, one that could harbor disease-causing pathogens and other harmful alga species.
It's certainly possible. And a lot of times certain toxins are oily in nature and they'll absorb onto the plastic. But when the microbes interact with it and could be releasing those toxins off of the plastic.
Some of those additives are known to have hormonal effects in humans. More than 90% of the trash floating on the ocean surface is plastic. The largest of the planet's five gyre sites is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is twice the size of Texas. Mincer says with so much plastic out there, it's important to know how it impacts marine species and, by extension, people.
Fish are eating the plastic, and are they picking up certain toxins from the plastic or not? And what does happen to plastic once it goes out into this environment? Does it eventually degrade and to little tiny bits? And then what does it do? Do the microbes make it heavier and make it sink quicker? Does it go away? Is it a problem?
Minster says the initial survey identified some 1,000 microbes that live on and interact with plastic. The next step is to sequence their genomes to get a better idea of whether or not they could be harmful pathogens. The research is published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Disney's animated film, Big Hero 6, is a blend of science, technology, and art. Cutting-edge technology was used in the making of the movie, and one of its key characters, a robot, is based on real-world science. Correspondent Elizabeth Lee reports from Disney Animation Studios in Burbank, California.
This action-adventure movie about a boy genius, his robot, and his friends started out as an obscure comic book. The directors kept the title and the characters' names, but transformed Big Hero 6 into something uniquely Disney.
We don't have any superpowered people in this movie. It's all super technology.
He's glorious. On top of
the world! Yeah, you're always walking a line. We want to push it so it feels fun and fantastic. Yeah. At the same time, you want it to be based on an actual science because people feel that it just makes it feel more plausible.
One real-world example is Baymax, a huggable, inflatable robotic nurse made of vinyl.
Our robot had to be something unique. It couldn't be something that we've seen before.
They found their robot in Chris Atkinson's robotics lab at Carnegie Mellon University. In this video provided by the university, Atkinson says,
most people think of robots either as tools for industry or military things. But when you say a robot is going to help you, be your servant or take care of you, that's a stretch for most people.
I am Baymax.
In Big Hero 6, the robot Baymax works to heal the sick and injured. That's not too far-fetched. Here at Carnegie Mellon University, scientists have built inflatable robotic arms. Their goal is to use that technology to help older adults and people with disabilities. In addition to featuring cutting-edge technology in the film, groundbreaking computer technology also was used to create the movie.
See, here's some more shots. Here's a great fly-through. You can see this is a full city. It's not just a few sets.
New software was used to build a city called San Francisco, where the movie is set. From the buildings to the characters and the geometry, this world is more complex than anything in the last three Disney films combined. With a more detailed world, the film needed a more complex lighting method. The studio created Hyperion, a computer program that simulates the technique of global illumination.
Global illumination is basically what you see around you in the world. Light comes in through the window over here. It bounces around in the world. It lights my face. It comes off this wall. It lights my face.
Hyperion harnesses the physics of how light works in the real world and applies that to this virtual world. Here's the difference.
So we're letting the light just bounce once in this scene. But 10 bounces allows the light energy to really flow through the scene and illuminate everything underneath the bed here.
Another piece of software created for this movie allows hundreds of thousands of people to be created in crowd scenes.
No two people are the same in this film. It's not like before computer graphics films where we had several different body types, several different head types, and you made 100 different people and they repeated. There are no repeats in this film.
The directors say the new technologies developed for this movie remove technological limitations for filmmakers in Big Hero 6 and future animated features. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Burbank.
No, back on.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com, also our Facebook page at VOA American Cafe. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios in Washington, D.C. Email us at americancafe@voanews.com. For all the people here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll talk with you next time on American Cafe.